Good morning, men. Chapter 1, verse 8. Morning, so we're just going to jump right into it. We are in Exodus, chapter 1, verse 8. Exodus, chapter 1, verse 8 is where we're going to start this morning. I'm just going to read the passage. Now, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor, in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, and the labors with which they rigorously imposed on them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was named Puah, and he said, "When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God. It did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?" The midwife said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can even get to them." So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who was born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep." Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and she saw that he was beautiful. She hid him for 3 months, but when she could hide him no longer, she put him in a wicker basket and covered him with tar and pitch. And then she put the child into the and set it into the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile, and she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you, that the Hebrew women, from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said, "Go ahead." So the daughter went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." The word of the Lord. So last week, I provided you guys with a very condensed summary of the biblical narrative leading up to Exodus, and we walked through the story of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At the conclusion of Genesis, the sons of Jacob, who's now named Israel, and their families were in Egypt. Though Egypt would ultimately become a place of oppression in those early days, God provided Egypt as a means of salvation, of deliverance for his people. This is another foreshadowing of things that were to come much later, because later in the story of the Bible, in the New Testament, Egypt would serve as a place of protection for Jesus and his family as they fled the persecution of Herod. Egypt did not know God, but throughout history, God used Egypt to preserve the seed of his promise. This is another theme of Scripture. Empires rise and fall, leaders pretend to greatness and appear to hold all the power, but in the end, they are but pawns in God's ultimate plan for his people and for his glory. Well, God had given his servant Joseph, who was one of the sons of Israel, a vision that a great famine was coming upon the land. And Joseph ascended to a power of influence in Egypt and acted in faith based on that vision. And he prepared Egypt for the famine to come. Well, that faithful preparation saved both the nation of Egypt and it saved Israel's family, because they came down from Canaan to live under Joseph's protection. Well, the Pharaoh under whom Joseph served honored Joseph in his service, by allowing his family to settle in the land of Goshen, which was an area between Egypt and Canaan. And in that region, the Israelites would manage not only their own herds, but also Pharaoh's own livestock. We see all that in Genesis chapter 47. But that privileged position of that family of the sons of Israel did not last. Joseph and all that first generation of the sons of Israel died, but their descendants were very fruitful and became exceedingly mighty, as we read in verse 7 of today's passage. We don't know how long it took for a Pharaoh to arise in Egypt who did not remember Joseph, but it was long enough that the original 70 people that we read about in the opening verses of Exodus, those who had originally migrated into the nation, had grown into a large enough people to pose a perceived threat to Egypt. Well, it's likely that this new king, the new king who arose and didn't know Joseph, is the Pharaoh who came to power after the expulsion of the last Hyksos ruler of Egypt. The Hyksos were a foreign peoples who had come from the northeast of Egypt, a land near Canaan, and the Hyksos pharaohs ruled in Egypt for about 100 years, and their expulsion was much celebrated in Egyptian history. So once an ethnic Egyptian ruler was again on the throne, you can imagine the nationalistic fervor that must have risen in the land. The hated foreigners had been expelled. Egypt was again self-ruled. But there was a fly in the ointment, an exceedingly mighty fly. There was a population of non-Egyptians who occupied the land of Goshen, which was on the border of the land between Egypt and the powers to the north. And this was an unsettling situation for the Egyptians. So the new pharaoh decided to act. This unnamed pharaoh's words regarding the Israelites have been echoed time and again by rulers throughout history who sought to enhance their power by declaring war against the enemy within, by demonizing the other, the foreigner, the great latent threat. Oftentimes in history, that enemy has been the Jew. For much of their history, the Jewish people have been without a home of their own, and so they've lived as foreigners and aliens. They've often held positions of great influence in the countries where they were a minority, but that's led to fear and hatred from the rest of the populace. In the U.S. today, only about 2.4% of the population is Jewish. But Jewish people hold an outsized influence in politics, banking, medicine, entertainment, law, education, and other influential fields, and that's been true in many nations at many times in history. Now, a person can respond to that disproportionate influence in a couple of different ways. You can appreciate that, acknowledging that God does seem to have his hand on these people, or you can respond with envy and paranoia, which leads to hatred and oppression. And too often, fearful populations have chosen the latter path. So consequently, for all of the Jewish people's great successes, they've been perhaps the most persecuted minority in history. Well, the first great persecution is recorded here in Exodus chapter 1. Well, as I was preparing this lesson, I was struck with the role that fear plays in this story. In fact, as I considered it over the week, I noted that fear and man's response to fear is a repeated theme throughout the entire book of Exodus. Pharaoh, for all the power he wielded, was afraid. In Exodus 1, we hear Pharaoh say, and paraphrasing here, these people are growing and expanding. They're taking up more and more land. They're powerful. In the land of Goshen, they're greater and more powerful than the native Egyptians are. We better be smart about this. We can't trust them. If people come to invade us again, what's to stop them from allying with their enemies and fighting against us? They're going to join with the people who hate us. Well, in this case, as is often the case, Pharaoh's fear led to sin. He decided to oppress the people he feared. No longer would they serve in an honored role, shepherding Pharaoh's flocks and enjoying autonomy. Those days were over because they were too big of a threat. Pharaoh turned the descendants of Israel, these once honored men and their families, into slaves. He appointed harsh taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and he used them to build the twin storage cities in the land of Goshen. Those were actually fortress cities that were designed to provide a buffer between Egypt and the powers to the north. Well, surely, Pharaoh thought, this hard labor would ultimately thin the number of Hebrews and lessen their influence and their discouragement. They would stop marrying and having children. They would meekly labor until they died early deaths under the strain. But God had other plans. We read in verse 12, but the more they afflicted them, Moses, and the more they spread out. And here again, we see the fear response. Moses writes that the Egyptians were in dread of the sons of Israel. Their very prosperity under persecution seemed to be working against them because the Egyptians responded to this growth, this prosperity, by increasing their labors. Verses 13 and 14 of chapter 1 emphasize the brutality of Pharaoh's oppression. Moses made sure that the reader cannot miss Israel's desperate need for deliverance. He uses phrases like lives, bitter, hard labor, all kinds of work, used them ruthlessly to hammer home the point that the situation was intolerable. But Pharaoh's plan wasn't working. In fact, the more he oppressed, the more the Hebrew population seemed to grow in numbers and in the area that they occupied. Well, this defied logic. It wasn't natural. This only made Pharaoh's fear grow. So in his fear, he moved from oppression to genocide. In verse 15, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. It's no mistake that Pharaoh, this great and powerful man, he's unnamed in this story, while the names of these two women are prominent. They are the heroes of the story. Now, they were almost certainly not the only midwives among the Hebrews, which was now a large population, but rather the lead midwives. And at this point, it appears that they had no families of their own, and they were probably devoted entirely to their craft. Pharaoh gave them a horrific command. If they were serving a mother who gave birth to a daughter, the daughter could live. But if it was a son, the midwives were supposed to kill that child immediately upon birth. Well, imagine, if you can, being one of those women. They were summoned before the king of Egypt, a person viewed as divine by his own people, the supreme ruler of this great and powerful nation, and he commanded them directly, personally, to do something horrific. These women had dedicated their lives to safely delivering children into the world, and for them, each loss they had witnessed, and surely they'd seen many, was a tragedy. Well, now he wanted them to kill every baby boy they encountered immediately upon its birth. Well, why the boys and not the girls? Well, it's probably because the girls could be more easily assimilated into Egyptian culture through marriage to Egyptian men. The Egyptians had uses for the Hebrew people, but they also wanted to destroy their sense of national identity. Setting aside the fact that Pharaoh's command was murderous, take note of what else was threatened here. God had promised that Abraham's descendants would be as great as the sand on the seashore and the stars in the sky. God's great Redeemer was to come from the seed of Abraham. Now, through a combination of genocide and assimilation, Pharaoh sought to extinguish the line of Abraham. Always, the enemy is seeking to interrupt God's plan for redemption. And always, the enemy fails. Well, the midwives were almost certainly afraid of Pharaoh. The Bible doesn't say that, but it's not hard to imagine. How could any mortal not be intimidated standing in front of someone who had the apparent power of life or death over you? And make no mistake, that's the implicit threat here, because to defy Pharaoh was to invite execution. But we see a critical statement in verse 17 that explains the midwives' defiance of Pharaoh's command. The midwives feared God. For whatever natural fear of Pharaoh they had may have harbored, they feared God more. Well, we might rightly ask, how did these women know God? How could they have known what God would have wanted them to do? There was no written scripture at this point. They had no law. They had no commandment not to kill, no written commandment. Well, we can expand the question to the figures in Genesis we talked about last week. How could Cain have known that it was wrong to murder Abel? In the absence of law, how could God judge the population by sending the flood? Why did God judge the debaucheries of Sodom and Gomorrah when there was no law against which these people had rebelled? But Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives, they had two things. First, they had the oral traditions of the Hebrew people that had been passed down since the time of Abraham. They would have known of the promise to Abraham and of the critical importance of preserving his line. What they also would have known, what all people, whether they be Egyptian, Hebrew, Hyksos, or Canaanite, would have known, even before the law, was that to kill these baby boys would have been wrong. They would have known it. How would they have known in the absence of the law? There was no Ten Commandments. Well, Paul writes in Romans 1, 18 through 21, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. We know that it's wrong to murder children because God has put that knowledge in us. God has made it plain to us. We know it's wrong to murder and to steal, to be sexually licentious or to be crass or cruel. We can harden our hearts. We can try to silence the inner voice. We can argue that morality is merely a relativistic social construct, but in our hearts, we know. There are those who would claim that morality is nothing other than social conditioning, a thing that we have to be taught, that a thing is right or wrong only when a law declares it so. And even then, it's really more a matter of social utility than due to any higher order of things. But it's not true. We know this isn't true. We know when we do wrong because God has put that in us. We are without excuse." This wasn't part of my lesson, but this came up in my Sunday school class Sunday morning. This is really the argument at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. The defense counsel's argument was, "We obeyed our law. These guys are innocent. They obeyed our law. Who are you to say that some other law we're beholden to?" And the whole theory behind the Nuremberg trials is there's a higher law. There's a moral law, and we all know it. We all know that you don't slaughter people because it just seems socially useful. Shifra and Pua were in a bind. They were asked to do a horrific thing that they knew was wrong. The potential consequence for not doing that thing was their own death. The consequences of obeying Pharaoh was a fate worse than death, because to please Pharaoh was to displease God. But they feared God more than they feared man. And that appropriate fear is what prompted them to do something extremely brave. They defied Pharaoh. Well, in time, predictably, Pharaoh became aware baby boys were surviving among the Hebrews. So he called the midwives to him. I can only imagine that they were terrified in this meeting. They had done the right thing. They knew they'd done the right thing, but they also knew that Pharaoh had the power to impose terrible consequences on them for disobeying him. "Why have you done this thing?" Pharaoh asked. Now, I suppose if these midwives were even braver, and if this were a movie or a fable instead of a true story about real people, they may have given a bold speech and called Pharaoh out for his sin and his cruelty. But instead, it appears that they lied. The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." Well, I've read a number of commentaries on this passage, and some scholars bend over backwards to try to explain that this wasn't a lie. And I suppose it's possible. I guess maybe the Hebrew women gave birth before the midwives could get there, but that would have been quite unlikely. Otherwise, why would there have been midwives in the first place? The most likely possibility is that these women lied, both to save themselves and also to save this generation of Hebrew baby boys. What's particularly notable about this apparent lie is that Moses writes, "So God was good to the midwives because they feared God. He established households for them." Now, the Bible repeatedly condemns lying. The admonition against bearing false witness is one of the Ten Commandments, but does God condone lying in certain circumstances? Well, it's a fair question, and I think that a nuanced answer to the question is appropriate because this isn't the only instance in which God appears to honor a lie. In Joshua chapter 2, Rahab the prostitute harbored Hebrew spies in Jericho. When the guards of the city came to her brothel to inquire about the men, she said she didn't know where they were. But Rahab is honored in both the book of Hebrews and the book of James in the New Testament as a great example of faith in the Bible. Now, is she honored because of a lie? A more modern example of this conundrum would be the many people in Europe who harbored Jews during the Holocaust, people like Corrie and Betsy Ten Boom. In Corrie's book, The Hiding Place, she relates instances where the Nazis showed up at her door looking for Jews, and she lied. Is she to be condemned for the lie or honored for her courage in saving those lives? Well, I think the fairest and most intellectually honest answer to the question is that God doesn't honor the lie, wasn't honoring the lie in either of those biblical instances. Rather, he was honoring the faith. In the scheme of things, man, we have to acknowledge that the evil of telling the truth would have produced was greater than the evil of telling that lie. Navigating these extreme situations in a wicked world is hard, and if we bring nothing to this world other than a flinty morality that doesn't recognize the difference in magnitude between lying to an evil ruler who wants to kill and telling a lie in order to preserve life, then we're not being as innocent as doves while also being as clever as serpents, as Jesus called us to be in Matthew 10:16. Back to the story. Pharaoh's attempted coercion of the midwives had failed, so he issued a new command to all of his people, saying that all newborn sons are to be cast into the Nile River. Well, note the shift here. So previously he tried to coerce the Hebrew women to kill their own children. Now he commands his own people to throw these Hebrew sons into the Nile River. He doesn't command killing by just any means, but he says, throw them into the river. Well, this is a way to escape some guilt, because the Nile was viewed as both the giver and taker of life. So if the Nile were to take a baby's life, well, that's the Nile's decision, isn't it? Well, a man and a woman from the house of Levi had a son. It's a courageous thing to do, to marry, to have a child in this environment. And he was beautiful. The mother was Jochebed, and the father was Amram. They harbored him for 3 months, but hiding him was becoming unmanageable. They sort of complied with Pharaoh's commands. They gave their baby up to the Nile River, but not before preparing a wicker basket with tar and pitch to make it watertight. The word that Moses uses here in the text to describe this basket is ark. And the only other place we see this Hebrew word used in the Old Testament is in the context of Noah and his ark. This is on purpose. Here again, God preserves his people and his promise through a vessel of deliverance. Well, it's likely that Hebrew mothers used this method, much like mothers today might leave a baby at the fire station that they can't take care of anymore. Moses' sister Miriam followed the basket as it floated down the river and into the reeds to ensure that someone would find the baby and care for him. Well, as God directed, one of Pharaoh's daughters was bathing in the river with her attendants, and she saw the ark. She had her attendant pull him from the river and took him in. Well, Miriam popped out of the reeds with an offer to provide a Hebrew midwife to care for the child. And so, by God's design, Jochebed not only got her baby back, but she got paid for doing the very thing she wanted to do, which was to nurture and nurse her baby. Importantly, because we see here that Jochebed had Moses until he grew, and then she gave him back to Pharaoh's daughter. So importantly, this allowed Moses' family to teach him the oral traditions of the Hebrew people to prepare him for his meeting with God that we'll talk about next time and his service to the Israelites. Well, that's the end of the narrative story today, but I want to talk about fear. Despite all his apparent power and proclaimed divinity, Pharaoh feared the Hebrew people. The Hebrew people no doubt feared when a new Pharaoh arose in Egypt who did not remember Joseph. The midwives feared when Pharaoh commanded them to do an unrighteous thing. Moses' parents feared when they gave birth to a baby boy whose fate would surely be death. All of us confront fear. Some people are more fearful than others by nature. Some people endure more frightening circumstances, but none of us is immune to fear. Some people claim to have people who claim to have no fear are the most fearful of all. People who are angry, controlling, prone to violence, because at core they fear that they are not, in fact, in control. The question is not whether we will experience fear. The question is who we fear and how we respond to fear. In Frank Herbert's novel Dune, characters confront their fear with a mantra repeating, "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration." Those of you who have been gripped with intense fear can understand this. Either that sudden rush of adrenaline in a moment of extremis, or the slow, grinding influence of chronically stressful circumstances can impede our ability to think rationally. Often we act out in unbecoming ways in response to our fear. Chronic fear takes a toll on our body and makes us irritable and robs us of peace. how we respond to that fear reveals a great deal about our character to this warping parallel belief. The great antidote to this warping, paralyzing, sin-producing fear, the antidote, ironically, is fear, a fear of God. Fear of God is a very different thing than fear of man or fear of circumstances. Man is often cruel and circumstances are arbitrary, but the power of man and circumstances to do true harm to us pales in comparison to the greatness of God. To fear God is to stand in awe of His sovereignty and holiness and to dread the thought of defying that eminence. In this recognition that God is both sovereign and good, we can have tremendous peace. When our fear of disappointing God outweighs our fear of man, we choose what's righteous instead of what's evil. To fear God rather than man equips us with extraordinary courage. In Psalm 56:11, David, one of the great examples of courage in the Bible, wrote, "In God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me?" Well, Pharaoh feared man, and he turned into a vicious, genocidal dictator who ultimately brought great suffering on his own people. Shiphrah and Puah, the Hebrew midwives, feared God rather than man. And God honored that fear by blessing them with families. And they also received the blessing of doing a thing that's remembered in history in preserving the seed of God's promise. They had the honor of being used by God in His great plan of redemption. Men, what do you fear? Illness? Financial reversal? Professional setback? War? The wrong political party winning in November? Death? Loneliness? Everyone faces these fears at some point and to some degree. God knows this, and the Bible acknowledges this. Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5:7, "Cast all your anxiety on Him." And the answer is the question, why? Why do we cast all of our anxiety on Him? Peter says, because He cares for you. Unsurrendered fear, the fear that you're trying to manage in your own strength, the fear that you're attacking with money and human machinations, will result in your own sin. In your effort to defeat your fear, you will revert to greed, deceit, wrath, hatred, unbelief. You will become selfish and introspective rather than thinking of others first. You will retreat into yourself in your fear and lose your saltiness and light. But your surrendered fear, the fear that you cast upon Him, the man-based fear that you swap out for the fear of God, that can lead to sanctification, courage, an increase in faith, victory, and the privilege of being used by God for His redemptive purposes in this fallen world. Pharaoh had all the wealth and power a man could want, and yet he feared, and so he fell. Shiphrah and Puah had nothing. They were impoverished and oppressed, and they also feared, but they feared God more. And unlike Pharaoh, we know their names. Unlike Pharaoh, they had not only temporal but eternal hope because they knew who held their future. Which of these characters, men, are you trying to emulate? Who would you rather be? I was a little rusty last week and I forgot my nugget. So to make up for it, I'm bringing you two this morning. But number one, make an honest assessment of your fears. What's keeping you up at night? List your fears and surrender them to God. Cast your anxieties upon Him because He cares for you. Nugget number two, whatever threats are coming at you from men, fear God more and allow that godly fear rather than human fear to guide your decisions. Respond to your fear with godly wisdom and with faith, considering what will be honoring to God rather than whatever you think might alleviate your present anxiety. Trust that He will honor you just as He has honored His faithful people through throughout history. We're going to go to the tables, and today, because of the format of this, no one's going to come up and conclude this. So table leaders, it's going to be incumbent on you to wrap things up.